Okay, ladies and gentlemen, while you're getting your lunches, we'll begin with this program. And it's a great program ahead of us. 7 years ago, almost to the day, the International Olympic Committee selected Beijing as the venue for the 2008 Olympics. Over the next 7 years, the Chinese government has built not only 12 new sites for the 37 venues of the Olympics, but a plan for presenting the new China on the world stage. Indeed, the Olympics are a unique opportunity for a country to showcase itself to the world, but it always doesn't turn out as planned. Berlin, 1936, Munich, 1972, Moscow, 1980. How should we view China for the 2008 Olympics? To direct this dialogue, we have one of America's premier journalists, sports journalists. In fact, he's a journalist with a sports beat. He writes for Time and the New York Times, as well as Sports Illustrated. He appears on Nightline, as well as ESPN, where he hosts Outside the Lines. He's written two major books on sports, and the one most relevant to our inquiry is the book, which he highlighted last year in a book talk, Triumph, the Untold Story of Jesse Owens and Hitler's Olympics. Jeremy Schapp.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have a rich discussion here. There's a lot of ground to cover, and I hope we can get to a lot of it. I want to introduce the panel, a distinguished panel. On my extreme right is my boss, John Walsh, the executive editor of ESPN, founding editor of Inside Sport magazine, former managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, and really the driving force and brains behind the birth of ESPN, the magazine, ESPN Radio, ESPN.com, and as such probably has more to say about the way sports are covered in the U.S. than anyone else. In the middle, we have with us the distinguished USA Today columnist, Christine Brennan, author of 7 books, including the mega bestseller, Inside Edge, about the world of ladies figure skating. She will be in Beijing. What is it, Chris, your 12th Olympics?
13th.
13th. It's only my 7th. So Chris will also be there working for ABC News, for Morning Edition on NPR, and just about every other acronym you can come up with. She will be working for everybody. To my immediate right is one of the world's leading, if not the leading, sports economists. His name is Andrew Zimbalist. He is the Robert A. Woods Professor of Economics at Smith College, a frequent consultant to major sports organizations, players associations, teams, leagues, and himself the author of several books. And we have with us a very distinguished guest. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce a man who 60 years ago today made his first Olympic team, Harrison Bones Dillard, one of the only people to have won 4 gold medals in the Summer Games. He remains this day in the 112-year history of the modern Olympics, the only man to have won both the 100-meter sprint and the 110-meter hurdles. He grew up in Cleveland, a protege of the great Jesse Owens. He received his first track shoes as a present from Owens and would equal Owens' feat by winning those 4 gold medals. So we are very lucky to have Harrison Dillard with us. In fact, I went to the archives. One of the advantages of working for a company like ESPN is that we have subscriptions to all these remarkable archive services. One of them has the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, and the LA Times going back to their first editions and reproduces them exactly, any story you could want. This is the lead story in the Washington Post sports section on August 1st, 1948. Dillard, the misplaced hurdler, surprises with stirring 100-meter victory over Ewell by Bob Considine, a legend in the business. London, July 31st, Harrison Dillard, the forgotten man of America's squad. That's because while Harrison was the world record holder in the 110-meter hurdles, he failed to qualify for the U.S. team in the hurdles at the trials and instead qualified in the 100-meter sprint, which was somewhat of a surprise. He surged back to a crowning triumph in the Olympic Games today, winning the stirring 100-meter championship. The skinny Negro, known as Bones, beat out Barney Yule, the factory worker and veteran speed king from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, by inches, an Olympic record-equaling time of 10.3 seconds. Yule led to within inches of the tape and was so positive that he was victorious that he jumped with joy as he slowed down after passing the finish. "I thought I had it. I thought I had it," Yule kept repeating to the calm and collected Dillard, who stood on a casual remark he made several days ago on the training field of the Uxbridge camp. When a friend sympathized with him as not being in the same class with Yule and Patton, Dillard replied, "I can run some too." And he proved it. Harrison, you weren't just in London in 1948. You were in Helsinki in 1952 as well as a competitor. Those games in London, historic because they were the first games in 12 years since Jesse Owens' triumph in 1936, were meant to showcase Great Britain in the rebuilding after the war in 1952. Of course, the great significance of those games, the first time that that the Soviet Union deigned to participate. You've been to other games as an official. You've remained active in the Olympic movement over the years as a radio host and public relations executive. In your experience, how much can the games mean to a host nation?
Oh, I don't think you can measure the value of the Olympic Games. Certainly in monetary or fiscal terms, it could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to a country. But I think it does a great deal when people of a country have those games in their own backyard and the pride that they can take and feel in being able to see those games conducted.
Chris, a little more historical perspective here. The IOC always likes to say that the game should be kept separate and distinct from politics, but every decision the IOC makes is to some extent a political decision just by awarding the games to a Moscow or a Los Angeles, or in this case to a Beijing, is a political decision. People who say that by awarding the games to Beijing, the IOC might facilitate the liberalization of the regime point to what happened, for instance, in Korea after the 1988 games. When the games were awarded to South Korea, it was a very authoritarian regime, and of course over the last 20 years has opened up to a large extent. Is there any reason to believe that the IOC had such good intentions by awarding the games to Beijing?
There is, Jeremy. You're right, it was 7 years ago right now, and many of you may remember the news that came out of that, which was that China is going to be getting the games, controversy, of course, then at the time, but there was the quid pro quo that China would change, that they would ease up on their dissidents, that they would potentially ease up on Tibet. Of course, the myriad of other issues that have come up since then as well, Darfur, of course, chief among them. But that was absolutely, it was said by IOC members, this is why they received the games. And as we've watched this develop over the last few years, it's so interesting because I think when you saw the torch relay and the protests in London, Paris, and then the Where's Waldo torch relay in San Francisco, where they had to hide it, the ultimate ignominy, and if it's not time to have the torch relay be about 2 weeks right before the games, I don't know when is the time for that. It's gotten ridiculous and completely out of hand. But when you saw the protests, to me, that there were, the torch was the magnet for the entire world saying to the International Olympic Committee and China, you haven't done it. You've blown it. And I think that was very appropriate. And when you feel bad for the torch runners, and you feel bad, of course, the athletes coming up in a few weeks here, and will there be protests, and will the shadow fall on them as everyone's focusing on Tiananmen Square or whatever may happen in China? We're prepared for anything. I blame the International Olympic Committee for making this decision and the Chinese government for not going along. And think about this. Last quick thought on this, Jeremy. Athens, 4 years ago. I'm sure many of you remember the pressure being put to bear on Athens by the International Olympic Committee in a very public, verbal way because Athens wasn't ready for the Olympics. I wrote a column in USA Today that the Greeks were not pleased with, I still think they're not pleased with, where I said Athens, Georgia is more ready to host the Olympics than Athens, Greece. And it was true, by the way, or a little, hyperbole, just a bit. But anyway, the point was Athens wasn't ready. and the IOC, president on down, they were very vocal. You saw the quotes in the paper. They spoke out. Greece has to get its act together. They have to get moving. Isn't that interesting? When it comes to structures, when it comes to concrete, they spoke out. But when it has come to the far more serious issue of human rights abuses in China, they have been silent, and they deserve to be criticized for that.
Can I add, just working?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I think the IOC has to make up its mind. They can't say that the games are to encourage world togetherness and world peace and that they're apolitical and then award games to Beijing on the premise that Beijing is going to liberalize. That's a direct contradiction in what their motivation is. As long as they're working on those contradictory premises, I think they're going to be putting their foot in their mouth over and over again. The other thing I wanted to add, and probably something we won't have a lot of time to get into, but the economic evidence on hosting the Olympics is not that it brings hundreds of millions of dollars to the country. It's that it's a neutral event at best. And it sometimes, in certain circumstances, can provide needed infrastructure, but it also provides white elephants that have to be maintained. The
Montreal was a disaster. Yeah.
Lots of them. I mean, Sydney is presented often as an economic success story. The local organizing committee said it broke even, but the Australian government says that the real cost is $2.2 billion because they have to, among other things, maintain a 90,000-seat Olympic stadium that costs them $30 million in operating costs every year. So the Olympics might be a lot of wonderful things, but as a tool for economic development, it has to be seen and used very cautiously.
John, with so many Disney and ESPN entities ramping up to cover the games, with the threats of terrorism, with possible protests, with performance-enhancing drugs, with perhaps more edifying stories of Michael Phelps, what do you think is going to be the story of the game?
What's great for our business, Jeremy, is that we don't know what that story is because all of these stories can develop in any number of ways. It's the most interesting Olympics in I can't remember how long because there are so many possible stories. You have human rights versus sportsmanship. You have what the people who are sponsoring, who are putting up the dollars for the Olympics, and what will be their statement about human rights in China. What will the story be outside of the venue? We're very limited, as you know, in what we can do because of the IOC's agreement with the rights holder, NBC. We have very limited access, but I think this time that's going to pay off for non-rights holders because there are going to be so many stories outside the venue of what's happening, not just in Beijing, but throughout the country.
Harrison, there hasn't been any serious talk about boycotting. There has been serious talk, though, about various ways of expressing dissatisfaction with the regime, with its reluctance to live up to the assurances it made at the time that it was competing to host the games. What do you think that athletes, politicians can do to express that dissatisfaction and to make it clear that they don't condone the behavior of the Chinese regime?
Well, let's before I answer that directly, let's go back to 1980 when President Jimmy Carter ordered a boycott and said if the Russians didn't get out of Afghanistan that, we would boycott. Well, obviously, we boycotted because the Russians didn't leave Afghanistan. I think it shows what is going to happen if you attempt to force any nation or any country to change their policies under threat of a boycott by a few hundred athletes. It's simply not going to work or have any great effect. The Russians, in turn, of course, boycotted us in 1984 when I guess in retaliation for what we'd done in 1980. It has no particular effect, I guess, upon the individual athlete, except those who don't get a chance to go. And that's exactly what happened in 1980. We had athletes who trained for a year, two, three, even 4 years, looked forward to taking part in these great international games. We denied that privilege or that right. And that's about the only thing that happens. As far as the Beijing games are concerned, I'm sure there will be no boycott, maybe by an individual here or there, but by no countries per se. I would think that possibly, I noticed that President Bush is going to the opening ceremony. If someone wanted to make a statement, why didn't he stay home? The athletes, they've committed themselves, of course. They're going. That's what they train for. But I think that he could make probably a much bigger, more important statement than any group of athletes could, simply by not attending, as would some of the leaders of other countries around the world.
Will there be any pressure on individual athletes to make some kind of a statement, harkening back to 68 with Carlos and Smith, and how they felt some pressure to make a statement? Do you feel that there will be anything like that with the individual athletes coming out of Beijing?
I would not be surprised if somebody doesn't do something. Again, that's something that we just don't know about, but I would not be at all surprised if somebody didn't do something. I know Carlos and Smith. I've seen them many times over the years. And they seem to represent, I think, in a great many ways, the thinking of American athletes. And I'd not be surprised if we see something.
Well, Christine, do you think?
I do, and I think, John, it will happen, of course, after their events.
Yes.
For example, Abby Wambach, the soccer star. There's a brilliant woman, a very smart woman, very, very focused on Darfur. There's Team Darfur, the athletes. You've probably heard of that. You can check their website. Joey Cheek, the speed skater you may have heard of from the 2006 games, who immediately went into the took his U.S. Olympic Committee bonus and prize money he won from winning a medal. Take the word amateur, throw it out. There are no amateurs anymore, which is, by the way, just fine, because that means they can be athletes and come back for many different Olympics, like Dara Torres, who won last night in the swimming, the 100 meters, as a 41-year-old mother, beating kids who are 19 and 20. And I think that's good. I think they grace us with their presence for so much longer. I think it's entertaining for all of us, and they can make money as opposed to having their parents have to mortgage the house three times to be Olympians while NBC makes more millions. But the reality is I think that some of these athletes are very smart and very sharp, and Joey Cheek is one who's been organizing a lot of the summer athletes. It's a tough call because there are rules, and any protests, as you know, Jeremy, any conversation can get you kicked out of the Olympics. On one hand, on the other hand, of course, there's the very American, and other nations, of course, have the same value, some of them, free speech, the opportunity to say what you want to say. There are questions about where you can do this, where you can't do it. I doubt they're going to take an Abby Wambach after if the women's soccer team from the U.S. wins the gold, silver, bronze. I doubt they're going to haul her off the medal stand if she does something. My guess is maybe we would hear it more in the press conference afterwards, where we reporters will be, I promise you this, we'll be asking questions nonstop of the athletes. What do you think? What have you seen? How do you feel about China? I think that, frankly, folks, is where you're going to hear more of the protest, not so much in a T-shirt or a salute, but more verbally in answers to questions.
But of course, while Smith and Carlos were not insulting the host nation, which happened to be Mexico, they were insulting their native country. We have a situation here where if athletes are protesting, it's not going to be the Chinese athletes. It's going to be athletes from elsewhere in the world. And when we have a games where it's not just the regime that is so invested emotionally, but it's also, from what I understand, millions and millions of average Chinese who take great pride in the fact that they are hosting these games, what good will that kind of protest do, Andy, if it serves only to inflame nationalist passions and to anger tens of millions of Chinese?
You know, I think in general one has to ask that kind of a question about any boycott, because I think a lot of boycotts are really about needing catharsis for the individual or the groups that engage in the boycott. What good did it do for the United States to boycott the Moscow Olympics? If anything, it just heightened some of the tensions in the Cold War. It came back at us 4 years later. What good did it do when Switzerland...
But even now, Carter and Mondale still stand by that decision. I mean, perhaps they have no choice.
Well, kind of, it ruined their Olympics economics.
Presidents never make any mistakes, you know.
It ruined
that.
Moscow's Olympics.
So Switzerland and Spain and the Netherlands boycotted the Melbourne Olympics in 1956 because the Soviets repressed the Hungarian uprising. You had African nations that boycotted Olympics during the 1970s because South Africa was allowed to participate. One might be very sympathetic ethically to the principles behind that, but if you're going to engage in a boycott, you should step back and ask the question, where does it lead? What good am I doing? And I think sometimes in certain circumstances, if they're well organized and they have a strategy, a boycott can be effective. But if it's just to make you feel better, then, you know, probably it's not a very good idea.
Yeah, I mean, technically, it's a minor point. South Africa had been banned since 1960, but New Zealand was being allowed to compete because New Zealand had allowed South African rugby team to act. I mean, it was so convoluted.
Right.
Anyway, John, though, you know, as you mentioned, ESPN and all the non-rights holders, so restricted in what we're able to do. I mean, you know, this is a story of vast importance, and yet, you know, we're being issued not that many credentials, and a lot of other news operations are in the same boat. How incumbent upon those people who do get credentialed then will it be to cover, and a lot of these people are sports journalists, to cover what's going on in Tiananmen Square, if there is anything going on outside the Olympic ring, as it were? How prepared is ESPN to do that?
Well, I think we're prepared to do it, and we can devote the resources to it if we make those kinds of decisions that there will be legitimate stories. The Olympics, for me, for my time, for the 20 years I've been at ESPN, it has always been daunting because it's the most controlled news event where you have really the least amount of access open to journalists. And in our business now, with what's happening at newspapers and in the news business cutting back, I think it's going to be a really difficult challenge for people to cover the stories outside of the events while covering the events. It's a matter of resources, a matter of access, and a matter of instinct, of knowing where to go and what the story is going to be. And we will, the American press coverage of this will dictate, I think, a lot of the world, America's and even the world's opinion on this. So I'm just looking forward to it because I think it's the most interesting Olympics to cover in my lifetime.
And don't you think NBC's in a very interesting position? And again, my, I guess full disclosure, you know, working for ABC News, ESPN, and NPR, as well as USA Today, obviously I'm competing with NBC. Jeremy, you and I will work together, be on rooftops or in studios
together.
Just
the two of us against their army of hundreds.
But, you know, that's fun because we can beat them at their own game. And here's why I think that, and we've done it. If NBC is a partner of the Beijing Olympics, anytime you have rights fees, ESPN buys a lot of events and is involved, or the sport buys, you know, the time on ESPN, whatever, and now you're in cahoots, as my mom used to say. Well, we're not in cahoots with Beijing, with the Olympics or the IOC. So this will be very interesting, and Dick Ebersol and David Neal are great minds, and they'll figure this out. But what does NBC do if this absolutely blows up? And you've got Michael Phelps swimming, but I've received a text message, and you've received a text message, forget Phelps, get out to Tiananmen Square. And believe me, that's where we go. We're journalists first, sports writers second. And so does NBC now continue to show the pretty pictures of the swimming venue, or do they go and show what's going on in Tiananmen Square, whatever it may be, or protests in the stands even, that the Chinese officials who they're contracted with, they're in business with, do not want them to show? Fascinating decision. We, on the other hand, will be able to report it like crazy. We did this in Salt Lake. We broke the story with ESPN and USA Today. We broke the story of the Paris figure skating scandal and beat NBC at its own game for a full week. And it was great fun. And so I think, you know, I know you feel the same way I do, Jeremy. Let's go at them.
Yeah, it's an opportunity.
There's going to be more. I think there's even more pressure on the advertisers who are underwriting the Olympics, and they've already been called into question about what their views are on the human rights issue. And that's cutting to the real heart. Will the American business press look, and the people who cover the advertising sector of American business, kind of hold the feet of the advertisers to the fire on human rights issues?
I'm outnumbered here. I'm not a representative of NBC, but I am friendly with some people who are involved with NBC, and I want to offer a small defense on behalf of NBC. And first of all, ESPN doesn't have rights to cover the games live, and NBC does. And so they have an obligation to American sports fans to be covering the swimming meets. I know that Ebersol plans to cover protests insofar as they directly impinge on the games. So I'm sure that they'll have some coverage. They won't have the same kind of coverage that ESPN and NPR has. They have this other obligation, and they also happen to be long-term rights holders for the Olympics. That's an asset of theirs, and they want to keep it as pretty as possible. So, you know, I think what you guys are talking about is fantastic, and you ought to do it, but I wouldn't necessarily dump 100% on NBC if they don't, if they're not as probing.
I'm saying, though, that because of the situation they have, it could become a big conflict. I'm not dumping on them at all.
Yeah,
they're the big G's.
Well, the key phrase there is as pretty as possible.
Yeah, and plausibly
right.
lies.
That's true.
Harrison, you know, it's often forgotten that, you know, when the 1936 Summer and Winter Games were awarded to Germany, Hitler was not yet in power. It was 2 years before the Third Reich came to power. They were given the games in 1931, and there was a lot of talk that the games would be disastrous because there would be boycotts from France and England, the United States, none of which was successful. And I don't want to draw any inapt comparisons between the Third Reich and the Chinese regime, but there are more than 100 liberal democracies out there. They could have chosen from any number of them to award the games as one of the pillars of the Olympic movement, one of the most decorated Olympians ever. What were your thoughts simply about choosing to give the games instead to a regime that has so many issues?
Well, like many people, I thought that it was ill-advised, simply because of the fact that China has the problems that it has, that its attitude towards human rights has been blatantly displayed in incident after incident. So why would you award them something like the Olympic Games in the first place? But they did it.
What do you think? What do you think Jesse Owens would think about all this?
I don't know. He'd probably suggest a boycott. I don't know.
Although the athletes rarely do, and he did go to 1936,
right.
there were only a couple of athletes who made individual statements by not going to the games. What do you think you'll be following most closely? I mean, we've got an amazing 100-meter race shaping up between the Jamaican Usain Bolt, who's now the world record holder, and the American Tyson Gay, who ran the fastest, albeit wind-aided, 100 meters ever just last week. What are you going to be following?
Well, there's nothing quite like, I guess, the 100 meters because it theoretically at least indicates who's the fastest human being on Earth. And having won that race naturally, I'm going to I'm going to follow it. I don't know that that is, you know, really true, but it is on that particular day anyway, and that's I think one of the great appeals that sports holds for the general public, that you don't know what's going to happen on any given day and in any given event under any given particular circumstances. So I will be following track and field. After all, that is my venue, you might say. But I like the Olympic Games, period. All of them, even the sports that I don't know anything about. I still find myself watching them simply because they are the Olympic Games. Theoretically, you become the best in the world in that particular event. And so to me, that means something. Having been there, having felt what it feels like to mount a victory stand and to hear your country's national anthem played and the emotional reaction that results from being put in that position has great effect upon an individual. And as I say, simply because I've been there, I guess perhaps I am even more aware of it than the average person.
Another reality of the Beijing Games is that it's the last time that baseball or softball will be played. In its infinite wisdom, the IOC voted to end softball and baseball as Olympic sports.
They've only been medal sports since 88, though, right? Baseball only since 88. So for 20 years in softball.
Think of all of the other sports that have been added in those 20 years.
You mean like women's modern pentathlon?
But, you know, in theory, they say that they did this because the United States Baseball League, Major League Baseball, wouldn't stop its season and send professional athletes over. We were only sending amateur athletes. So the great irony of these games that until the 1980s were only amateurs, you now take away the national pastime of the United States. It's going to hurt Major League Baseball a lot less because they've created their World Championship Series, a separate entity.
Which
it's going to hurt women's sports. It's going to hurt women's softball much more, and it's going to hurt other countries that play baseball. Baseball, after all, is a game that's played well around the world, not as much as soccer, but it's a very popular sport.
Well, and this was a window, really, into how the IOC works, which is a bunch, really, it's Eurocentric. It's a bunch of, 60, 70, 80-year-old white men.
Careful what you say.
Are you 60, 70, and 80?
I'm 80.
Hey, nothing wrong with that. But the reality is that's who's running the International Olympic Committee. And what they did, they had a vote, and the softball people did not anticipate, unfortunately, how the vote was going to go. They wanted to get rid of a few sports to downsize the Olympics. How ridiculous is this? I mean, this is like, taking one water bucket out of the Titanic. I mean, this is, absurd. And so they decided, they got confused, thought baseball and softball basically were the same, Europeans. United States wins them all, stick it to the United States every chance they get. They love our sponsor dollars, but hate the U.S. winning everything. And so they just voted, and they really didn't even, they admitted later, oh, gosh, we didn't mean to do that. They had a revote, but then they were so embarrassed about how they would look if they revoted against it that they then still voted to kick softball out. Here is Jacques Rogge, the president of the International Olympic Committee, whose stated goal is to get to 50-50 male and female participation in the Summer Olympic Games. It's about 59-41 or 58-42, male-female right now. But it's getting closer. The glass is definitely half full, almost half full. And then they get rid of a women's-only sport. It was absolutely absurd. They blew it. They know they blew it. They'll probably bring it back for 2016, which could be in Chicago. But this, to me, ladies and gentlemen, is the absolute window into the world of the people running this organization and why they would give it to Beijing versus, say, Toronto. To open up the world to 1.3 billion Coca-Cola drinkers and 1.3 billion McDonald's eaters, which is really the reason they gave the Olympics to China.
While we're venting on Olympic committees, international and our own, I have a sort of something that, it just irritates me. The fact that, I sit here now 60 years after having won my Olympic championships, and yet, we can find money to do anything we want in this country, sending men to the moon, Mars, whatever. And yet, the individuals who don the red, white, and blue, compete in the Olympic Games, and win the medals, be they gold, bronze, or silver, whatever, or just compete for this country, that years later, they're never invited to go to the Games. I don't know why the Olympic Committee or somebody can't set up something that would enable former athletes, if not all team members, just medal winners perhaps.
If you're bucking for a trip, Harrison, we could probably get your credential at this point. you'd be one of the few.
Andy, as Christine hit on this, I'm curious from your perspective, what are the economic effects for American businesses in awarding the rights to Beijing and opening up the 1.3 billion people?
I make it straightforward. They're looking for consumers. It's a country that's growing at 10% plus per year over a protracted period of time. Projections are it will continue to grow. Their motivation is to find new markets. So it's going to depend on how well they market and the particular product they have, but I think it's potentially a bonanza. And look at the American sports. They're all trying to go over there, but they can only do it in a very limited way. We can't very well have a Major League Baseball team in Beijing and have our teams travel back and forth. Goods are much more portable than sports are. So I think there's potentially a much larger benefit for manufacturing companies and even service companies if they can crack that market.
Perhaps I've been remiss as our moderator here. Maybe the first question I should have asked, laying the foundation of this discussion, was, John, the Chinese have proved by what they've said, by their actions, that these games are of paramount importance to them. This is a country with 1.3 billion people, a dynamic economy. In so many ways, people are expecting China to be the story of the 21st century. Why do these games, which are going to be 16 days, matter so much?
I think it matters that what Andy said and you just said, it matters to them in an economic and a business sense. And what the world and the Olympics are looking for is what do the values matter?
And that conflict coming together with the sponsorship and the arrest of the dissidents and all of the Tibet clashing together are what the story of these Olympics are about.
Well, Jeremy, your late father, the great Dick Schaap, loved the Olympics. And I know you get your love of the Olympics from your if you don't all know who Dick Schaap was, please Google him immediately and buy
one of the best.
Buy all of his, how many books did you write?
Only 30.
Only, right. Buy one of those, you know, in the next day or so. But he was my hero and one of the great, great people in our business. And we miss him. I know you miss him all the time, but we all miss him. But he loved the Olympics. And he would be the first to tell us that it is the greatest scheduled peacetime gathering of the world. And it is only 16 days. But people in Tokyo in 1964, that reopened Tokyo to the world after, of course, the World War II. Munich, many people forget, but when those games started in late August of 1972, the idea was to show a new Munich to the world following, again, following World War II and all that we knew of at that time, West Germany, of course, East Germany were separate. And then that was just shattered on September 5th, 1972, when 11 Israeli athletes and coaches were taken hostage and then killed by Arab terrorists who snuck into the village, just jumped over a wall, and the guards thought they were athletes coming into the village late, and of course that security immediately, Olympic security became September 11th style security right after that. But that was the tragedy of those games, but that was what Munich was hoping to be until that was shattered, as Jim McKay so eloquently told us in the early dawn of September 5th, 1972. So then Seoul, you mentioned Seoul, North and South Korea. There was concern, I remember going to Seoul, and there was concern that the North Koreans would open up their dams and flood South Korea. And it turned out after some protests that it ended up now 20 years later with a much more cooling of tensions and a very different situation in the Koreas. That's what the games can be. It is the greatest gift that can be given to a nation. So I think to answer your question, that is what China is hoping for. This is their coming out party in a way they could have no other, and I think that's why it's so important to them.
In 2001, when this was set up, China hadn't really quite established its present position in the world economy. I think back then it was more needed than it is today. And China cannot do what Tokyo did in 1964, because it's not opening up. It's going to be a walled city. They're going to be spending $2 billion plus on security, and you're not going to be able to show the bustling Beijing life. You're going to be able to show empty streets.
But do you think that's a mistake? I think that's a huge mistake. I think the Beijing officials are gagging their brains out going into this and making a big mistake.
They have made every wrong move since in the last year. Every step of the way, the arrest, the walling off, what their intentions are to do with the factories and the traffic during the games.
Well, one last question for each of you before we open it up to the floor. What I'd like to know, and Harrison, you were there at the inception of, let's call them, the Cold War Olympics. And for 36 years, the games meant so much to so many millions of Americans, in particular because of the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. Since the 1992 games, the first in which there was no Soviet team, how much do Americans really care about an Olympics anymore where it's not us versus them? I mean, certainly the ratings show that they don't care nearly as much as they used to.
Well, they care every 4 years when the Olympic Games are held. I think between, in the interim, there's little or no interest in the Olympic Games. But to get back to China or any other country that hosts the Games, as was mentioned, the Chinese are making, I think, a big mistake. If they would simply open up, let the athletes meet and their own people, their people who have read about these athletes, who have heard about these athletes, worship these athletes almost in some cases. If they would simply let the athletes go around through their country freely, openly, I think it would improve perhaps the world's opinion about them. They could use the athletes in that sense. So it's a question, I think, that as they say, many sides to it. But anytime you open up whatever you're doing and have a degree of transparency, I think that you will benefit in the long run.
John, the disastrous earthquake claiming about 70,000 lives in China certainly, you know, forced the Darfur and Tibet stories from the headlines for a couple of months. And the Darfur and Tibet activists, you know, have been out there saying, you know, this is a horrible thing, obviously, and we have sympathy for the people whose lives have been lost and their families. But that should not create sympathy for a regime that, in their eyes, remains wholly evil. How has the earthquake affected, and how will it affect coverage of the games?
I think the effect is being felt now. I don't think it'll be felt in August. And there's an opportunity because of the location of the country and all the effects with Darfur. And Americans are very sympathetic to natural disasters, and that becomes such a big news vehicle for us and a window into looking at a culture. And I think that we have, I think that journalistically, the mainstream news press coverage of Darfur and what's come out of that has had a major effect. And it's been so different in the last 15 years of what the American foreign press has done with the coverage of that. And even in the book press, if anybody hasn't read What is the What, it's a marvelous book on Darfur by David Eggers and a bestseller. And I think that, to me, that kind of coverage, and that's the top of it, shows what we can do as members of the press to shine a light on this, which is not a natural disaster, but something that was caused by humans and is so horrible. I think that there will be a focus, and there will be people kind of shining a light back on that as we get closer to August 10th.
I'd like to open up now to the floor. Please just wait until you get the microphone so everyone can hear your question. Who has a question? Oh, yes.
When ABC had the television rights in 1972, they did not fail to cover the disaster in any way. Now, that's a long time ago. NBC, as you said, they're journalists first, too. What reasons do you have, what concerns do you have, that should something happen, that they would fail to be responsible in reporting those things? Because they're taking hundreds of people.
Yeah. Well, I'll go first. I think Andy maybe even mentioned some of the problem, that they do have, maybe they're serving two masters, and I phrase that as a question. They're in cahoots. They're absolutely in with the Beijing people. There's a IOC member, Gilati, who is on the NBC payroll. I mean, it's, you know,
from Israel.
But their primary role there is to cover the games, and the hundreds of people are there, and they will not. The Bob Costas of the world. If something happens there, they will certainly cover it, and they're very well resourced to cover that. The question is, what will they cover if there's not a big news event? Will they be covering on an ongoing basis the story of China and as we've seen it unfold in the last 24 months in the American press?
To your point, they also have many other networks. So MSNBC could go live with protests. But I can guarantee you this, ABC News would be live completely with the news because there would be no pull or tug to have to go back to the swimming venue. And exhibit A of how sports sometimes has trouble with this, much less of an important story, although very important. Augusta National, the golf club, when the issue rose to a head, and I was involved with writing columns on this, about no women members. CBS Sports refused to mention a word of it in their broadcast, even though it was all over the front page of the sports sections of every newspaper in the country. CBS News, I think, did a piece every night. But you turned on that golf broadcast and you would have had no idea what was going on outside the gates.
If they had mentioned it, the Masters would now be on ABC and ESPN.
Yeah. So it is a problem for a network involved with sports. Definitely. Absolutely.
Yes, sir. Oh, can you just wait for the microphone? Oh, I'm sorry. All right, we're choosing that way.
Yeah. Hello. Speaking of a Chinese earthquake, that was something that was brought to the world's attention greatly by, you know, the internet, you know, folks sending signals out, you know, literally within 3 hours, people knew what was going on and probably forced an openness on how that was covered If you remember 30 years ago, there was a similar magnitude of earthquake that took 3 months to be reported, whereas there was within 3 minutes. So I guess my question is, in regards to anything that comes up, how much will the Internet aid and perhaps augment the coverage that will, you know, be happening perhaps?
Well, I mean, let me address it first. I mean, we're not even sure at this point whether we're going to be able to use the Internet as foreign correspondents over there. Now, if you're talking about, you know, Chinese people getting on the Internet and reporting themselves, it's my understanding that, you know, while stuff will get out there, the Chinese employ more than 30,000 full-time Internet censors.
That works better with information coming in than going out.
Oh, okay. I think news will get out there. There's no doubt about it. You can't control everything in the way that you could at one time because of the Internet. But I expect that we're going to have a much more difficult time disseminating information from there than we had, for instance, from Athens or will have in London.
And Jeremy, I was there last September on a pre-Olympic trip, and I kind of forgot I was in China. I was emailing AOL, no problem. You know, everything went fine. So I'll email columns to USA Today. I would use my BlackBerry. Of course, you can use the old-fashioned way. You pick up the phone and you dictate. So I don't think anything's going to deter the journalists from getting the word out back to the States.
Now, the Chinese government did arrest 250 Internet users 6 months ago through their censors.
Bloggers, yeah. Yes, sir.
Can you speak more about the kinds of restrictions that will be placed on specifically the non-rights holders in China about where you can go, what you might be able to see, et cetera? I was under the impression, actually, from last year at the Ideas Festival that there were major restrictions, most of which were being taken away just for the Olympics and would be put back again immediately after the Olympics. But in terms of your ability to go to Tiananmen Square or further or out into the countryside or your ability to report, what kind of things are you expecting the government to restrict?
Well, for Jeremy and I both, we were talking about this yesterday, we have what are known as e-credentials. I'm a print journalist credential, which is the best access. I can go any venue. So it's like NBC in that sense. Then I would leave the venue to do an ESPN. We did that for the skating in Torino, where we're just outside the fence, or actually I think we were just inside the fence, and did a quick hit, taped something, Jeremy and I. So we're really, I think it might be more just general journalist restrictions completely. I mean, right now NBC, the Today Show, is being told they cannot be in Tiananmen Square. So rights holder or not, I don't think there's any differentiation at this point vis-a-vis the government. I can't imagine NBC's thrilled. I don't know what you know about this.
It's been very tough. I mean, you know, we're 5 weeks away from the opening ceremony at this point. While we get assurances that our credentials will be approved and that we're going to get our visas, none of it's happened yet. The building that we are sharing broadcast facilities with CNN, the BBC, a number of other non-rights holders to this point doesn't have its fiber optic set up. You know, if we walked in there today, there'd be no way to actually broadcast. Now we keep getting assurances again that by the time August 6th, 7th roll around, everything's going to be in place. But, you know, how do we know? I mean, you know, I suspect that it will happen. But, you know, they're also going to have the ability at any moment to flip a switch and turn us off. I was watching the Today Show a couple of weeks ago. Meredith Vieira couldn't get in from the Today Show. I mean, they're the face of the Olympics. So, you know, what chance does anybody else have? CNN has a very difficult situation right now because it's widely despised in China after one of its morning anchors, Jack Cafferty, made some comments referring to the regime as a bunch of thugs. And there are people I know, friends of mine at NPR, who are 1,500, 2,000 miles from Beijing who've never heard of CNN but now know who Jack Cafferty is and, you know, are, you know, burning effigies of him. So it's going to be interesting. Yes.
Though many of us, our hearts lie with Darfur and Tibet, I wonder if we haven't undervalued the human-to-human contact. I mean, if the Internet has trouble over there, imagine how wonderful it's going to be when you're sitting next to a Chinese person or you're walking down the street. I was there in October, and they're so excited, the people. They love Americans. All the service workers are learning English to read, to write. They all have English names. I think that they're a very respectful group of people. I think calling the government thugs, is they consider that very disrespectful. Mm-hmm. I don't think we serve our purpose when we speak like that. And
I think
I'm
CNN agrees with you.
And yeah, my hope is that the contact between people will go beyond what the net can even do, because we could discuss Darfur, Tibet, and debate it with the person who was, you know, we met. So I think that it was given to China, though it's precarious what the, you know, how much was economic. I think this is a great coming out party. They're so excited. They're not going to be going to work. They're making sacrifices. It's just away from isolationism. So I hope that that is going to be okay.
I think everybody hopes that it will be that. What we're talking about is the likelihood that it won't be that way. My sense is that there'll be fewer tourists going to China this summer than there were last summer. Five-star hotels now, I think, are 70% booked. Four-star hotels are 45% booked. The Chinese are making it very difficult for people to get visas. There are a lot of controls. So it was intended as a coming-out party back in 2001. Whether it will function that way or not is a very different matter.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, nobody, you know, is going over there with any agenda aimed at the Chinese people. It's about whether the regime actually lives up to the assurances it made to secure these games in the first place and allows the Western press to cover the games in an unfettered manner. Any other questions?
Earlier this week, on that same stage, we had a moderator, Kurt Campbell, who had been in China last week, and he toured the Olympic Village, and he made the observation that it, his words, one of the most polluted places he's ever seen. And I'm struck that no one has mentioned anything about the environment and the impact on
my fault.
China's image and the athletes. So if you guys could comment on what you've seen, heard, and what that impact will be, that would be great. Thanks.
Well, as I said, I was there last September, and when I threw open the, well, walking through the airport to get to customs, I started to feel a scratchiness in my throat, and I thought, oh, it's just because I've been traveling for, you know, 18 hours or something. And then I went out to get a cab, and I couldn't. It was just amazing, and it was. I realized I was already feeling the air in my throat, even while I was in the airport going through customs. The next day, I threw open the draperies in my hotel room, and it was this awful gray, cloudy. And I said, oh, it's raining, and I looked on the pavement, and it wasn't wet; it was dry. That was pollution. And that was the end of September. This will be the dog days of August. August 8th is when they begin, 8808, and to the 24th. So it's kind of like Washington, D.C. in August, if any of you know that. It's just the humidity and the so it's even going to be worse than the end of September. Now, they're trying to do a lot of things, the odd even on the license plates, shutting down factories. The question is, how much can they do? As you may know, Gebre's. Yes, in the clouds, you know, so who knows, if they better not overdo that and have 40 days and 40 nights of rain. That wouldn't be so good. But Haile Gebrselassie, the men's marathon world record holder, is not running the men's marathon. He has asthma issues, and he refuses to do it. So what a comment, isn't it, that here this is the greatest, all you want to have great athletes in every sport, but the best in the men's marathon will not run the men's marathon simply because of what you just described.
Well, it's a fitting symbol that the Beijing government in getting the Olympics has called great attention to environmental reporting.
Exactly.
The other thing that'll put a little bit of a crimp in our enjoyment of the games is, of course, that it's on the other side of the world and it's 12 hours different than us. So there'll be a lot of people who, even if they're interested in a particular contest, won't watch it because it'll happen when they're asleep. And I think that's going to help the other news agencies that are there, because it's going to highlight the relative importance of the political events and diminish the relative importance of the competition.
And of course, that also goes a long way to explaining why NBC, unlike the rights holders before NBC, have made it so difficult for everyone else to cover the games, because they don't want everybody to know the news before they go on the air with their primetime show, which will be 10, 12 hours.
I think they figured that one out, Jeremy. I think they got one.
Well, and that's the TV side. The print side is we are on shekel. We can do whatever we want.
Well, John, you know, I mean, they still cling to the plausibly live model.
but that's why if you want news, you know, you wake up and you've, of course, you've just already had the day in China. You may well go to NBCOlympics.com.
Yeah, this will be the coming out party for NBC.com.
Right. Or I would encourage you to come to USAtoday.com because we will all be doing that all through the day. And again, I think, or WashingtonPost.com, New York Times, wherever you go, you will see incredible coverage while you've been sleeping because we will have that opportunity. So the print and the website, we can really make a difference, I think, in the coverage because of the time difference.
Yeah, well, one more question, anybody? Yes, sir?
One of the things we didn't talk about is the international presence of athletes affecting the U.S. team. For instance, Bernard Lagat, the possible gold medal winner for the U.S., was
a naturalized citizen.
Exactly. He was African a couple of years ago. Most of the greatest athletes in the NBA will be on other international teams, not the U.S. team. So I wonder if you can just talk about sort of that sort of concept of all the international athletes. Maybe Harrison.
Well, you know, I mean, once you become a citizen, you run for who? I mean, one of the most interesting stories to me at the Games is going to be, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, Becky Hammon,
right.
Who was the best player in the WNBA a year ago, did not get invited to compete on the U.S. women's basketball team and instead is going to be playing for Russia because she spent a season playing in Russia and is able to claim, well, not official citizenship, at least Olympic movement citizenship.
Right. And the Russians were happy to have her. A girl from South Dakota is now going to be wearing Russia,
yeah.
And trying to beat the U.S.
Yeah, this is what happens, and it's only appropriate, I guess, as a nation of immigrants that we'll have Bernard Lagat out there to finally win a distance medal for the U.S.
But this has been going on for quite a while. Back in 1976, many of you remember Dorothy Hamill. I was still in high school, but I remember staying home and watching her beat Diane DeLue. Diane DeLue was from Holland. That was the country. She was from Southern California. And her parents had, of course, citizenship, so she knew she couldn't beat Dorothy Hamill in the U.S., and she competed against her and won the silver medal.
It's interesting, though. It is different than international soccer. Once you suit up and play in an official national game, even if you're under 17 in soccer, you are that country forever. George Best, the great... maybe the greatest player in the Premier League in the 1960s and 70s, had made perhaps an unwise decision to play as a junior for Northern Ireland, where he was born, and then could never represent England, and Northern Ireland never made it to a World Cup, so he never got to play in a World Cup. Whereas in the Olympics, you can change nationalities, you can be in one of the biggest controversies in European speed skating, which I know you follow closely, Elliot, was a few years ago. The Dutch speed skating team is so strong that Bart Veldkamp, one of its best skaters, didn't make the 1994 Lillehammer team, so he decided to move to Belgium for a few months and then skate for Belgium. And they allow you to do that in the Olympic movement. Most of the federations, not all. Remember, these are not IOC decisions. This is, International Track and Field Federation rules. This is International Speed Skating Federation rules, et cetera, et cetera. They're the ones who make the eligibility rules, but that's the way it works. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank our panel, John Walsh, Harrison Dillard, who will be celebrating his 85th birthday on Tuesday. Happy birthday, Bones. Christine Brennan and Andy Zimbalist. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good job.
Oh, my pleasure.